tower on Fifth Avenue, who was either between wives, stepping out, or merely window shopping. I was able to locate one Society page photograph of the duo at some charity gala, in which the man appears to be wearing an unusual green ring on his left ring finger, but the resolution of the shot proved insufficient for closer examination. In any case, their relationship was short-lived. As this was near the nadir of the man's whiz-bang financial exploits, rife with bankruptcies, noxious litigations, and other related derring-do, one suspects that the ever-resourceful Lana may have managed to finagle a peek at the man's bottom line and decided she should chum neighboring waters for bigger fish. Gee, wonder what ever happened to that guy. The man she eventually married, by the way, bested Doug Milford's matrimonial stamina by a substantial margin, as the happy couple lived in wedded bliss all the way until 2008, when the mogul dropped dead of a heart attack in Antigua, the location of their winter palace, during his morning jog on the beach. Once again, the widow Lana made out like a bandit. I hear tell she drifted toward the south of France, but at that point I lost track of the woman, or should I say interest. As a kindred spiritual cousin to Vivian Smith, her story lacks the edifying moral fiber I prefer in my cautionary tales. Lana certainly had amassed enough bank by this point to call it a day, and to put it kindly, with regard to her preferred line of work, the engine was still running, but the chassis needed an overhaul. Anyway, who cares? As my mother used to say, trash is trash, even if it's in a Tiffany bag. TP, September 6, 2017. Federal Bureau of Investigation. Case number 008-072-0119, Bureau File Number TP, 11 of 18. Case Agent Tamara Preston. Dr. Lawrence Jacoby, Confidential. You'll recall that when the dossier last dealt with Dr. Jacoby, the town's freestyling New Age psychiatrist, he had just been informed by the Washington State Medical Board that for his full 24-hour diner menu of ethical code violations, his license to practice medicine had been summarily revoked. Awaiting judgment, Jacoby then repaired to his childhood home on the Hawaiian island of Kauai. Living off savings and a tidy sum left to him by his recently departed brother Robert, he spent the next 2 years in Hanalei Bay, gone to ground, licking his wounds and searching for a way to reinvent himself. While he could no longer legally hang up a shingle, the good doctor showed no inclination to abandon his well-trodden path dancing along the margins and the outer precincts of reality's most radical possibilities. Jacoby threw himself into field studies with Hawaiian shamans and alternative medicines, which he chronicled in an early online blog, which we'd call it today. A substantial chunk of this content focused on the way of the Menahuni, the folkloric little people of native South Sea Islander culture. Akin to similar mythologies in many other Aboriginal traditions, leprechauns, pixies, elves, et al., the Menahuni are usually depicted as mischievous nature spirits and master builders of various inexplicable engineering projects, usually involving stone and water. I'll spare you most of the colorful details, Chief, but on more than one occasion, Jacoby claims to have made contact with the little folk, who revealed to him that they're not of earthly origin and that their mission here on Earth is to help steer the newer root race of human beings away from our unfortunate genetic propensity for violence and self-destruction. Setting aside for a moment the efficacy of their mission, if we judge these wee folks solely on the degree to which they've succeeded in this regard, they're running well below standards we apply to basic government work. Jacoby also mentions a competing theory, more archaeology-based than mystical, that these little people may simply hail from an earlier race of smaller humanoid bipeds, as in pygmies, who settled the isolated island chain some eons before the migratory Polynesians showed up in their outriggers. He also offers that this doesn't in any way rule out the possibility that the little people were alien in origin to begin with, putting us right back where we started. UFOs and the Greys make a brief appearance here as well, which gave me the giggles one night, after two glasses of wine, when I found myself picturing them in grass skirts. Anyway, you get the drift, and at the least, I think this now gives us a reasonable working hypothesis for the basis of Jacoby's enduring bond with his old friend Jerry Horn, Killer Weed, to which I now feel compelled to reiterate that Jacoby lived in Hanalei Bay, first made famous as the home of Puff the Magic Dragon. As the internet mushroomed, Jacoby's blog gradually brought him back to some fraction of his previous 1960s notoriety, and to the attention of many prominent counterculture figures who had through the years kept, as they like to say, on truckin'. At the personal invitation of an unspecified band member, Jacoby spent most of 1994 and 95 on the road with the Grateful Dead, or as I once heard Albert refer to them, the world's greatest bad garage band. Did you know Albert is a stereo and vinyl enthusiast with a jazz collection that numbers in the thousands? Yes, you probably did. Whether Jacoby served the band as a senior spiritual advisor, the doctor's version of his job description, or, according to one ex-roadie's more blunt assessment, the bonsai pipeline to all manner of psychotropic traveling, Jacoby's time on the bus came to an abrupt end with the untimely death of singer and lead guitarist Jerry Garcia. I believe that Jacoby's enduring fondness for loud and colorful neckties is most likely a tribute to his old friend. Jacoby's peripatetic ways continued. He next turns up as a resident fellow with a sketchy progressive think tank in Amsterdam called the Zonderkop Institute, which translates as born without a head. The organization itself, however, was born with a head. It was founded in 1981 by one Dr. Joost Poopjes, which translates, and I'm not making this up, as Dr. Little Poops. According to its website, the Institute's mission statement claims it is dedicated to, this is my own slightly rougher translation, finding alternative ways of raising human consciousness and fast before we blow all this shit up. The Institute's address places it directly upstairs from a popular hashish bar owned, I'm guessing not coincidentally, by Dr. Little Poops himself. I have come across a theory explaining this weird Dutch last name business, although it may be of interest only to me. Holland was occupied by Napoleonic France for a short period at the turn of the 18th century, during which time the French instituted the country's first comprehensive census. It seems many of their unhappy Dutch subjects may have offered ridiculous and, to the non-Dutch-speaking French bureaucrats tallying the count, untranslatable surnames as a mild form of protest. For example, the wildly popular surname Niemens, which means nobody. In the end, the joke fell more heavily on the Dutch after Napoleon met his Waterloo and the French split the lowland scene but left the goofy names behind. Dr. Jacoby's own two-year stay in Amsterdam came to an end in 1998 when Dr. Little Poops decided that the impending, and it turned out entirely media-driven, Y2K crisis signaled the end of civilization as we know it. Along with a few diehard followers, Dr. LP repaired to a secure and unspecified ecological biosphere in the far north of Sweden to hunker down during the apocalypse. And there Dr. Little Poops vanishes from the radar screen of history. Jacoby did not attend. Taking this millennial setback in stride, Dr. Jacoby returned stateside and headed straight for Florida, where he pitched in as a volunteer during the hanging Chad portion of the 2000 presidential election recount. He spent whatever free time this gig allowed by offering lay counsel to distraught, defensive former Ralph Nader supporters. Although no longer able to work as a licensed physician due to his loss of credentials, Jacoby released a noteworthy lay paper on his findings online, identifying what he called the defiant liberal denial syndrome. The article got some play in a few progressive media outlets and helped persuade Jacoby that it might be time to turn his still formidable power of mind toward political activism. His decision was reinforced less than a year later. Jacoby happened to be in New York City on 9/11, participating in an anthropological conference on shamanism at the Museum of Natural History. In the days that followed, during countless hours of volunteer work that he spent comforting the wounded and traumatized, he came to view the terrorist attack through the eternal lens of cause and effect, or to state it more simply, karma, and interpreted it as the first toll of the bell striking midnight for the American experiment. He predicted, correctly and with no evident glee, that the government would overreact, lash out at the wrong targets, and kick off an even more destructive cycle of cause and effect that would only make the emerging global crises worse. When the search for weapons of mass destruction came up empty, kicking the legs out from under the administration's rationale for invading Iraq, Jacoby took no pleasure in learning that his instincts had been confirmed. He interpreted this as confirmation of his theory that the United States, and perhaps the world, might be entering into what he saw as Kali Yuga, an ancient Hindu term for a dark age. In 2003, on the wings of that vision, he decided it was time to head back home to Twin Peaks. The purpose of this second return was not to re-engage with a community he'd abandoned, and in truth, felt abandoned by, more than 10 years earlier. Instead, Jacoby bought a used mobile home and hauled it up to a remote hardscrabble acre that he bought for peanuts near the peak of Whitetail Mountain. Once he'd set up shop, he began making supply runs into town, at most once a week and usually after dark. The only person in the area I can verify he reached out to directly was his old bud, Jerry Horn, who I believe became the first and only outside financial contributor to Jacoby's new enterprise. Lawrence Jacoby evidenced zero interest in reliving any part of his former life in Twin Peaks. He had embarked on a new mission now, a vision fueled by rededication to his youthful 60s-era radicalism. He dedicated the next year to educating himself about all the advantages the internet now offered as a means of distribution for his idiosyncratic messianic vision. During this period, he carefully crafted a new persona for himself to serve as the herald of that message, a character he called Dr. Amp. In 2006, just after he turned 70, Jacoby launched the first live episodes of what he predicted would become his internet media empire, and the Dr. Amp Blast made its debut, streaming live, 1 hour a night, 5 nights a week. Although the early editions vary wildly in quality, he made them all available online after each live stream, as some of the first podcasts, his message and tone remained remarkably consistent. Dr. Amp offered a ferocious running critique against a world turning mad, a common-sense prophet offering a nightly jeremiad that rallied against the ignorant, the privileged, and the false. He remained a true believer in medicine and the scientific method, tie-dyed, of course, with his 60s New Ageism, preaching truth against what he described as the rising forces of corporatism, the corruption of wealth inequality, and the corrosive effects of what he called cannibal capitalism on the human mind, body, and spirit. Dr. Amp not only tossed out political perspectives amid a regular diet of crackpot conspiracy theories, but he offered up practical home remedies to counteract their negative effects, alternative medicines, herbal supplements, ancient methods of meditation and spiritual renewal. Jacoby had done his homework. Dr. Amp's nightly crusades quickly struck a chord and garnered a small but intensely loyal internet following. Most of his local listeners from Eastern Washington, even including those who'd previously known him in and around Twin Peaks, had no idea where he was broadcasting from or who Dr. Amp actually was. That changed, at least in Twin Peaks, when he began video streaming his program in 2012. By 2009, when the economic bubble burst and the big banks nearly went under, plunging the national and global economy into an abyss, Dr. Amp's message of defiant hope, activism, and individual responsibility struck an even more resonant chord. The mystery of Dr. Amp's identity became an indelible part of his mystique, and by 2012 his reputation began to spread beyond the regional into the national. He refused a few attempts by mainstream media outlets to co-opt his message or seduce him with the idea of reaching a broader audience by waving buckets of cash in his face. He had saved more than enough money over the years to support his modest lifestyle indefinitely, and, as he made clear in his very first offering, as far as people thinking I'm crazy at my age, I just don't have any fucks left to give. He did, however, eventually happen onto a unique ancillary revenue stream of his own. In 2015, Dr. Amp began a direct mail operation after a number of his followers responded to one of his frequent admonitions to dig yourself out of the shit, a central theme of his call to self-empowerment, urging people to fight back and seize control of their own lives and destinies. Before long, he added the ideal tool you could use for the job, a, at first, metaphorical golden shovel that his followers could visualize to help them complete said task. The desired transformation through undertaking this assignment he described as a process of intrapersonal alchemy, turning the lead of dull everyday consciousness into the gold of an evolved human soul, the goal of what he described as a hallowed tradition in esoteric philosophy harking all the way back to the Middle Ages. This led to Jacoby offering literal golden shovels for sale, simple garden spades that he personally spray-painted gold, 2 coats, in a series of home-crafted commercials, and before long he was selling dozens and eventually hundreds of them a week. Fittingly, he seems to take no interest in using this sideline for personal gain. An examination of his recent tax returns shows that his corporate income grew by 2.5 times, and 90% of it he anonymously donated to a variety of charitable progressive causes. So do we conclude that through this new identity and means of expression, Dr. Jacoby has dug himself out of his own shit? I have to add, while I generally don't find much common ground with either the doctor's complaints or his prescriptions, listening to his show offers some peculiar pleasures. He comes across as a buoyant and likable personality, fueled by righteous indignation, unbound by convention or any shred of need for our approval. Jacoby remains nothing if not a dyed-in-the-wool gadfly whose synapses appear to fire more or less coherently in more directions at once than a daisy cutter. Lawrence Jacoby is over 80 years old now. There is an air of Tarot's Magus about the man, the ancient archetype of a magician who's outlived or conquered the base temptations of life to reach spiritual serenity while still maintaining the height of his powers. As I think of Dr. Jacoby, Dr. Amp, a character like Prospero comes to mind, a man in the last act of life who survived the tempest of human turmoil and by doing so gained the ability to see beyond its commonplace illusions. A man who lives at one with nature and its pagan spirits, whose developed senses can now pierce the veil of existence and leave him able and willing to share the wisdom one mines from such hard-earned territory. King Lear would be the tragic version, a privileged man who arrives at the same place through loss and hubris that will eventually cost him his life. That Jacoby's personal ground sits atop a mountain in a remote range in eastern Washington, which the dossier has established is as steeped in mystery as any ancient Himalayan peak, seems altogether fitting. As you may be able to tell, Chief, I'm experiencing a bit of a what's-it-all-about moment with this inquiry. I'd like to believe there's more to life than what we can see or lay our hands on, but the job keeps us so focused on the evil that men do that it's a challenge to hold both thoughts at once. My research tells me that people drawn to law enforcement professions, if they're thoughtful at all, perpetually struggle with this conundrum. How do we dig ourselves out of that particular shit? I suspect this is part of why you've asked me to take all this on, to instigate the process of confronting that riddle within myself. Is that the secret at the heart of the Blue Rose and the work we do? To identify root causes of human misery and evil, do we first have to find them in ourselves? A Jacoby P.S. Chief, I've found a postscript to Dr. Jacoby's arrival back in Twin Peaks, and it produced an indirect and positive bank shot consequence to many of the people you know there. As we learned in the dossier, the hard luck romance between Ed Hurley and Norma Jennings had over the years run into more impediments than a congressional funding bill. Every time a crack of daylight appeared offering a possibility that they might finally get together, fate slammed the window shut with a steady stream of murders, imprisonments, nervous breakdowns, you name it. The return to incarceration of Hank Jennings seemed to signal the end of this cycle, only to be replaced not long after by the tragedy that befell Annie Blackburn, with Norma devoting herself to her full-time care. Then, no sooner had Annie's worsening condition required permanent around-the-clock hospitalization, another window, than a serious setback in Nadine Hurley's delicate state of mind pulled Ed back into his guilt-ridden caretaker role for her. A year after that, when Nadine finally appeared to be on the mend, and Ed had worked up his courage to break away from his troubled wife once and for all, his nephew James drove his troubled life into a ditch requiring Ed's help. When Leland Palmer died in police custody after confessing to the murder of his daughter Laura, the most innocent of her local boyfriends, a grieving and disillusioned James, took to the open road on his Harley with no plans to return. Not long afterwards, after being taken in by a predatory older woman outside Portland, Oregon, James stumbled into the role of hapless Patsy in a murder scheme straight out of noted noir novelist James M. Cain. I won't bore you with the details. Although James narrowly avoided being charged with any crime, he later appeared during trial as a witness for the prosecution. When the highly skilled defense attorney tore his testimony apart, casting serious doubt on James's character, if not his version of events, James felt threatened enough by loose talk about how he could be charged with perjury that he impetuously and unwisely fled town before completing his testimony. A bench warrant was issued to ensure his return. It didn't. We know now that James kept driving all the way to Mexico, where he hid out in Baja, working as a mechanic under an assumed name. The young man didn't have a criminal bone in his body, but trouble sure had a knack for finding him. Major Briggs referred to this in the dossier as something the family has always sarcastically called Hurley luck. James managed to lay low down Mexico way for close to a year, until he got lucky again after repairing the wounded engine block of a Lamborghini Diablo belonging to a Sinaloa cartel capo. In the parlance of the aforementioned Cain, the engine was suffering from a bad case of lead poisoning. Someone had opened fire on it with a Schmeisser AR-15 spitting hollow-tip steel-piercing ordnance. This cocaine cowboy took such a shine to James's handiwork that he offered him a full-time job at his Hillside Jalisco estate, maintaining the hotshot's fleet of 17 exotic luxury vehicles, another waving red flag the size of Texas that James seems to have missed. About 6 months later, a rival gang showed up one morning to execute the capo in a hostile takeover. This dog's breakfast involved an undercover sting, crooked cops, and a rogue DEA agent who'd been turned by the cartel. James was one of the shootout's few survivors, having hidden in the trunk of a Rolls, but in the aftermath he was swept up by the federales. Word of his indefinite detention in Mexico eventually found its way back to the Twin Peaks Sheriff's Department. With his friend, Sheriff Harry Truman, along to help sort things out, and I've been told a few helpful calls placed by a certain deputy director of the Bureau, a few months later, a Mexican judge cleared James of any involvement in the proceedings and had him escorted to the border, where he was instructed to leave the country and never return. But an immediate return to Twin Peaks wasn't in the cards. That court in Oregon still wanted a pound of flesh from James for fleeing his bench warrant. His abrupt departure from the trial had not, in the end, deterred the jury from finding the defendants, Evelyn Marsh and the paramour who had been posing as his brother, guilty as charged of murdering her late husband. Attorneys and judges put their heads together and decided that for his sins, James owed Oregon 6 months of his life in minimum security, followed by 2 years probation, during which time he would not be allowed to leave the state. This weighed heavily on Uncle Ed, who rented an apartment in Portland so he could spend alternate weekends making sure James didn't succumb to his congenital wanderlust or step on any other bear traps. With Ed's steady presence, James satisfied the conditions of his parole, then immediately took to the open road on another Harley. By the time this drama was over and Ed returned home, Nadine had just opened her drapery store in Twin Peaks. It was an immediate, if modest, success, and Ed felt obliged to be supportive as Nadine worked around the clock, which tossed yet another railroad tie on the tracks in front of Ed finally getting together with Norma. Stalemate. Hurly luck. A decade passed, as they do. James eventually came back to Twin Peaks in 2006, this time on a Trailways bus. He'd totaled his Harley in an accident involving a runaway coal truck in West Virginia some months before. Hurly luck being what it apparently is, he suffered a compound fracture of his leg and ended up flat broke in a county rehab facility. James had edged past 30, and at this point the bloom faded permanently from his Kerouac romance with the road. Once his leg healed up, he went back to work for Ed at the gas farm, and a few years later he took a second job working night security at the Great Northern. He lives alone, modestly, drives a used Ford Focus now, still plays guitar, writes plaintive, simple, and appealing songs, unrequited love, heartbreak, and so on, that he sometimes performs locally, and as far as I can tell, has never hurt another human being. As I pieced together how James Hurley's life unfolded, this truth they taught at Quantico came back to me, Chief. Just as any criminal can be an accessory to a crime, an entirely innocent person close to an act of violence can become a collateral victim. You can call it Hurley luck, but this could have happened to anybody. It just seems to me that a part of James died when Laura did, and it has haunted him ever since. You'll be pleased to learn that happier outcomes lay in store for a few others in town who I know you're fond of. As she soldiered through her troubled private life, Norma Jennings threw all her available energies during these years into the Double R, making it a center of community pride during hard times. When the lumber industry in the valley died and the Packard Mill was shuttered, a lot of people were out of work. She extended credit and reduced prices to families she knew were hurting and made all her excess food available to the homeless. When the economy recovered, Norma took a leap of faith into franchising her beloved eatery. She even briefly dated the big city slicker from a comfort food corporation who wanted to make Norma's a household name in a number of other locations throughout the Pacific Northwest. This decades-old logjam began to break up late one night when Nadine was doing her books in the back office of Run Silent, Run Drapes. While surfing the net, she stumbled across an episode of Dr. Amp's nightly rant. Recognizing her former therapist immediately, she was hooked like a trout. With the unique kind of fervor she could bring to lunatic causes, Nadine soon bought herself a mail-order golden shovel and a few more for people on her Christmas list. She installed one of the golden shovels like a holy relic in the display window of her drapery store, while embracing the entire Dr. Amp lifestyle. Drinking the Dr. Amp hemp protein shakes, doing the Dr. Amp Walking in Nature program, following his rigorous crusade for political renewal by donating to a variety of nonprofit charities he supports. Taken in its totality, Dr. Amp's brand, if you will, is one part Amway, one part Anthony Robbins by way of Timothy Leary, one part Grateful Dead. Nadine's enthusiasm quickly turned into a kind of religious devotion that appeared to do for her what 30-odd years of traditional and crackpot therapeutic approaches had failed to achieve. It restored her to a balanced, happy, and functional life. During one of his weekly nocturnal supply runs, Dr. Jacoby noticed one of his spotlit golden shovels hanging in Nadine's window. He stopped, knocked on the door, and laid eyes on his former client for the first time in more than two decades. I can't tell you exactly what they talked about, although rumors suggest they may now be dating, but less than 2 weeks later, Nadine marched over to the gas farm and forthrightly handed Ed his walking papers, the release from obligatory matrimonial bonds he'd long ago given up hoping he would ever receive. That same day, Big Ed Hurley, pushing 70 in front of the lunch rush at the Double R Diner, proposed to Norma Jennings, who, it turned out, was just at that moment giving the city slicker and his plans to take Norma's diner corporate the heave-ho. To paraphrase Vince Lombardi, timing isn't everything, it's the only thing. You'll be pleased to learn, I think, that Ed and Norma got married not long after. James played a song he wrote on his guitar during a civil ceremony conducted by the big log near the old train station. All of their friends, half the town, it seems, were there. Andy Brennan bawled more or less throughout, and I'm told even Deputy Chief Hawk got a tear in his eye. His old friend Big Ed's Hurley luck had finally turned. TP, September 6, 2017. Federal Bureau of Investigation. Case number 008-072-0119. Bureau file number TP, 12 of 18. Case agent Tamara Preston. Margaret Colson, confidential. As you know, just prior to your arrival back in Twin Peaks, Margaret Colson, known locally as the Log Lady, passed away after a long battle with lung cancer. In the weeks and days before her death, we learned that she made a significant contribution to the Cooper investigation, one that led to a breakthrough from the Twin Peaks Sheriff Department's side of the case. Her funeral was widely attended. The newspaper said it seemed that the entire town had turned out on the shores of Pearl Lake. There was no conventional service, but people were invited to speak if they wished to pay tribute, and many, many people got up to share their favorite log lady stories. Deputy Hawk was the last to speak, and he read from a page that he said Margaret had given him the day before she passed. He sent this on to me, and I include the text here. "Every meeting between friends must end with a parting, and so, my friends, today we take our leave. This is life. None of us profits from ignoring or hiding from the facts, so why should we bother? Life is what it is, a gift that is given to us for a time, like a library book, that must eventually be returned. How should we treat this book? If we are able to remember that it is not ours to begin with, one that we are entrusted with, to care for, to study and learn from, perhaps it would change the way we treat it while it's in our possession. How do you treat a precious gift from a dear friend? That is a good question to ask, and today is a good time to ask it. Such busy, busy minds we have you noticed? We think and we think until we twist ourselves into the ground like a flathead screw. My log has this to say. The answers to all our questions are in the wind and the trees, the rocks and the water. No one is helpless, no one is beyond helping. It is good to seek out those who need us and do what we can for them. I recommend that. There is nothing that can't be done if we set our minds to doing it. Don't be sad. Be happy you have another day to do what needs doing. We only have so many of them. We are born into this world, not another one. It's not perfect, but it is what it is. This world presents some simple, certain truths. It helps us grow if we accept them, but many of these truths seem to trouble or frighten us. For instance, there is no light without darkness, and this troubles many of us, but without it, how else would we tell one from the other? We spend half of every day in darkness. Surely we should make our peace with this. You may decide to see this as a metaphor. Many people do. I see it as a fact. Metaphors are beautiful ways of speaking about the truth. So are facts. Both tell us that time, and light and darkness, moves in cycles. We move through them, too, often as passengers, but if our eyes are open, there is much to be learned along the way. A traveler learns more than a passenger. When darkness comes, a traveler learns to be brave, for they know the light will return. Anyone who spent a night alone in the woods learns this. When a dark age comes, hold the light inside. That's where it lives anyway. There are forces of darkness and beings of darkness, and they are real and have always been around us. They're part of the dance, just as you and I are. They're just listening to different music. This may be the most troubling truth we will ever know. Many of us live most of our lives and brush up against this reality only rarely. It is far from pleasant, but wishing it were otherwise will not make it so. So may I offer a suggestion? When a dark age comes, just as you would at night, hold the light inside you. Others, I can tell you, have already learned to do the same. In time, you will learn to recognize the light in yourself and others. In this way, you will find each other. Together, you will make the light stronger. This truth I know as sure as the dawn. Darkness will always yield to light when the light is strong. Margaret asked that her ashes be scattered in the Ghostwood Forest, and so they were later that day by members of the Sheriff's Department. She left her log to Hawk. He keeps it on his mantle. He reports that it hasn't said anything to him yet, but he says he's keeping an ear open just in case. With all I've learned about Twin Peaks, Chief, and all you've told me, my only regret is that I never got to meet Margaret. As you know, I don't consider myself a religious person. But when I read these words of hers, sometimes I think maybe I'll get my chance someday to meet her, not to become religious. TP, September 6, 2017. Federal Bureau of Investigation. Case number 008-072-0119. Bureau file number TP 13 of 18. Case agent Tamara Preston. Sheriff Harry Truman, confidential. You specifically asked me to find out why Sheriff Harry Truman had left his post as you discovered upon your return to Twin Peaks. Agent Cooper's fondness for his friend and former colleague is well established, and the reasons are abundantly clear. Truman was everything a local law enforcement officer should be. Sensitive to the needs of his community, protecting and serving in equal measure, modest in word and deed, and as solid and dependable as the sunrise. In the aftermath of the Palmer case, however, Truman was nearly finished by a defining trauma of his own. His ruinous relationship with the dangerous sociopath Josie Packard. I believe the staunch support Agent Cooper offered his friend after her death helped preserve his sanity and may have well saved him from self-violence. The sheriff had clearly been damaged by his loss, but not irreparably so. Harry Truman was made of sterner stuff. He lived his whole life in Twin Peaks, son of the town's previous sheriff, as you know. I've studied his entire career. While Harry could at many times have smudged the line between extracurricular vigilantism and the strict limits of the law, specifically through the offices of the local social club he eventually led, known as the Bookhouse Boys, a closer examination of their history has convinced me that the boys have always acted in accordance with the spirit of the patriotic Home Guard Truman's father founded during World War II. In my opinion, the Bookhouse Boys represent a moral counterweight to the many recent and negative examples we've seen of homegrown rural and so-called libertarian militias. As badly hurt as he was by Josie's betrayal, I believe Harry may have been even more haunted by the sudden disappearance of his friend Cooper. From the records I've come across in his files, Harry never abandoned his own investigation into what happened to Cooper. Some of those details, pertinent to our own work, are included later in this document. And that for the next 20-plus years, he never gave up on it. Harry reached retirement age recently, and as you know, the story told around town that he had turned in his badge for a fishing pole and a seat on the sidelines was not true. I've confirmed that just as his brother Frank told you on the phone, 6 months before your return, Harry had learned he was seriously ill. I've confirmed that it's cancer, and he's still living and undergoing treatment in a research hospital near Seattle, but he's fighting uphill. Typically private, unwilling to burden anyone with his troubles, Harry kept this news from everyone at the station and in town. His older brother Frank, who had recently retired after his own long and distinguished career in law enforcement in Western Washington, seems to have been the only one he told about his illness, although Hawk, who knew Harry better than anyone, figured it out right away. Frank agreed to move back to Twin Peaks and take the job for 2 years to help stabilize the department, with the understanding that he would then step down and hand the reins to Hawk. My sense of this, Chief, is that, given his personal regard for you, if you made the effort to reach out to Harry, he would respond and be more than grateful to hear from you. TP, September 6, 2017. Federal Bureau of Investigation. Case number 008-072-0119. Bureau file number TP 14 of 18. Case Agent Tamara Preston. Major Briggs, confidential. So much of what brought us back to Twin Peaks and ultimately led to our finding Agent Cooper, we clearly owe to Major Garland Briggs. The dossier he compiled and left for us, with its multitude of intriguing leads and frankly incredible tales, is a puzzle we'll still be reviewing and unraveling for years to come. Among the questions we haven't settled, even in the aftermath of resolving Cooper's disappearance, is what exactly happened to Major Briggs himself. Here's what we know and what I've put together about the timeline. We know that the man whom Sheriff Truman found in the sycamore grove after Agent Cooper's disappearance was not, in fact, Agent Cooper, but his double. We know that when Cooper's double checked himself out of the hospital the next day, it paid Briggs a visit at his home. We know that Briggs had been expecting a visit from his new Blue Rose Control after the death of Doug Milford, and he may have assumed or even been told that Agent Cooper was going to be that control. During the double's visit, Briggs became alarmed by the interaction and wrote about it in his final entry of the dossier. Given his intuitive capacities, it's not too great a supposition to assume that Briggs realized, at some point during their meeting, that the man in front of him was not Agent Cooper, and that this was the reason for the Mayday call he wrote as the last words in the dossier. We can also assume Major Briggs realized that, rather than confront the double, he'd best keep that realization to himself, but given what we have since learned about the double, it's fair to suppose that it saw through Briggs's intention. We know from Mrs. Briggs that shortly after the double left their house, Briggs departed for Listening Post Alpha, his classified Blue Rose station up in the mountains. Mayday protocols required him to secure, or destroy, all of the secure data contained there, and also stipulated that he disable or destroy most of the more advanced and classified technology he'd been using to conduct his study. When Briggs got there, one of two things then happened. Either he successfully enacted those measures and then staged a scene to make it look as if the post had been ransacked and that he himself had been attacked, or, at some point during his staging, the double arrived and a genuine and deadly sacking and assault took place. In either case, given the DNA evidence found at the scene, Briggs's fingerprints, blood, and tissue, the forensic impression seemed clear. The post had been breached, during which Briggs had, in all likelihood, been attacked. A few days later, when the wreckage of Briggs's car was found at the bottom of a nearby canyon, with a charred and unidentifiable corpse inside and a few of Briggs's teeth conveniently placed nearby, death by accident became, as you know, the official conclusion of the investigation. Reports of the attack were suppressed by our internal investigators, and no suspects were ever publicly identified. It's clear now that the only reasonable suspect was the double, and I believe it's likely he followed Briggs up the mountain to the LPA later that same day. Briggs appears to have conducted such an elaborate deception to fool exactly one person, the double. That effort appears, at least at the time, to have succeeded. Given what we have subsequently learned, I believe it's reasonable to conclude that the scene at the LPA was, for the most part, staged by Briggs and that he subsequently escaped with whatever classified material he could carry with him, which I believe later became the basis for the dossier. A few miles from the outpost, Briggs then staged the crash of his own vehicle, leaving a severely burned corpse inside to complete the illusion and facilitate his escape. If and when the double arrived at the scene after Briggs had already left, he most likely made his own search of the property, departed with whatever he found, and perhaps set the fire to cover his tracks. I believe it's less likely but still possible that the double arrived while Briggs was still on site, but there were sufficient security measures in place that Briggs had ample warning of his approach, giving him enough time to escape before the double actually got there. This all remains impossible to determine with 100% accuracy. What, if any, data the double itself took away from the LPA, we can't actually know. But if his arrival rushed Briggs's departure in any way, it's possible that the major may have left something pertinent behind. Both Briggs and the double then vanished from sight for the next 25 years. Here's where the story gets dicey, and by that I mean the laws of time and space as we understand them may not necessarily apply. As you know, the following is based primarily on testimony gathered from our main eyewitness in Buckhorn, South Dakota, the now-deceased high school principal William Hastings, whom I questioned personally. For the past few years, Hastings and his girlfriend, local librarian Ruth Davenport, have been dabbling in speculative esoteric occult research. Together, they authored an amateur blog about their work, which they posted on the internet. They titled it The Search for the Zone. According to Hastings' testimony, at some point during their last year together, they claimed to have made contact with a person or entity that identified itself only as the Major. They were eventually told they could make personal contact with this individual by entering into some sort of non-physical or metaphysical dimension. The Major told them that this encounter would occur at a specific time and place in or near an unspecified entrance to this zone. The location he gave them for meeting happened to be a derelict vacant lot on the wrong side of the tracks in Buckhorn. Once they were inside the zone, the Major, whom Hastings described as hiding or hibernating inside of wherever this was, appeared and tasked them with finding a set of important coordinates from a secure military database. From Hastings' description, it seems that during this initial conversation, the Major revealed himself to them in more or less corporeal physical form. As we've now been able to confirm, once Hastings and Davenport succeeded in hacking this military database, most likely with clues provided by the Major, and obtained the information he was after, they returned to the same location of the zone a second time to personally deliver it to the Major. As they were about to give the Major these coordinates, according to Bill Hastings, all manner of hell broke loose. The Major floated up toward what he described as a vortex or portal, presumably like the one you witnessed yourself, Chief, and dark, shadowy figures appearing out of nowhere assaulted them. Both Davenport and the Major were decapitated in the attack, and Hastings was left unconscious but alive in the vacant lot. He seemed to suffer some form of memory loss about this event, and his memory returned only after his arrest. A few days later, Davenport's severed head, aligned perversely and tenderly on the neck of the body of the Major, was discovered by local police in her apartment. This eventually led to our involvement and our arrival in Buckhorn, including our interrogation of Hastings. It also led, weeks later, to our discovery of Briggs' secret dossier, which one has to assume Briggs also gave to Hastings and Davenport at their first meeting, and which Davenport had concealed in a basement storage locker in her apartment building. This suggests, to my mind, that wherever he'd been for the past quarter of a century, the Major had taken the dossier with him. The body was identified as that of Major Garland Briggs, and his age was determined to be roughly 45, which just happened to be how old he was at the time of his disappearance 25 years ago. Shortly after Buckhorn police took Hastings into custody, his wife Phyllis was shot to death, allegedly by her attorney, lover, who shortly thereafter also died when his car exploded. This entire local crime wave, the preponderance of evidence now confirms, was committed by the double and his henchmen. To recap, Hastings attempted to show us the site of the entrance to the zone, where we discovered the body of Ruth Davenport in a vacant lot, and where you had your own glimpse of the zone, during which time Hastings was mysteriously killed, assaulted by an unseen assailant more or less right in front of our eyes. The coordinates the two of them had given to the Major were found in the arm of Ruth Davenport, where she'd apparently written them down in order to verbally relay them to the Major. Hastings indicated that he'd cautioned them to put nothing on paper. Those coordinates eventually led us back to Twin Peaks, the truth about Diane, and the final collision at the sheriff's station between Cooper and the double. Do we doubt that any of this actually happened? It's hard to argue with when, for a large part of all that ensued, we were eyewitnesses. So, where exactly had Major Briggs been hiding or hibernating for 25 years? After faking his own death, did he make the ultimate escape? Did he slip inside some sort of portal near Twin Peaks, its location revealed by these aforementioned coordinates, where time proceeded to stand still for 25 years while he evaded the double? Given our Bureau training, or dare I say bias, to regard our human existence as science-based reality, how is this idea something we can even consider as remotely possible? And yet we have before us a substantial amount of what one is compelled to concede is supporting evidence. Exhibit A, the 45-year-old body of Major Briggs, which appears impossible to refute. For the purposes of my report, let's accept this as a known unknown. But we can take it further. The idea of these coordinates revealing, okay, I'll say it, the existence of multiple locations of entrances into what I'll label, for our internal discussion only, other space-time dimensions, is the next conundrum confronting us. Certainly the Major making entrances in Twin Peaks and an exit in Buckhorn to meet with Hastings and Davenport suggests that at least one other such portal exists.